Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to begin the next session. Recognize there's only been a few moments since the end of the last session, but we are running a little late. And the topic is to be discussed is so interesting, I think we properly should give it all the time we can possibly allot to it. Our principal speaker in the next session will be Peter Appleby, who's Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Utah. His topic will be Finite Theology and the Problem of Evil. Professor Appleby has received his BA from Hamilton College, which, for those of you who are from the Northeast, will recognize as being in New York State. Did some graduate work at Harvard Divinity School and received his PhD in philosophy from the University of Texas. Responding to his paper will be Gerald Bradford, who many of you know is a professor in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. It's from that institution that he received his PhD in religious studies. Thank you.
First, a preliminary remark or two. This paper has been touted as a paper on Mormon theology and the problem of evil. It is not that. For two reasons. One, that I am not anything like an authority on Mormon theological thought. And secondly, because the small amount of investigation that I have done on that subject leads me to believe that there is not available a single clear official statement of Mormon conception of God that would be accessible for a discussion of this sort. That's one preliminary remark. The second is that in the paper I try very briefly to encapsulate a broad range of traditional responses to the problem of evil, and I don't altogether succeed in doing that. For those of you who are interested in a more thorough examination of the general topic, I have brought with me some outlines of the problem of evil and strategies for response to it, and I have a few copies of those that someone might like to pick up at the end of the session. The third remark is this, that people of my acquaintance, some of them Mormons, tend to assume that a finitist theology, a limited conception of God, obviously resolves the problem of evil. Or makes it such that the problem doesn't arise. What this paper tries to do is to explore that finitist option, to see what would have to happen to the conception of God traditionally held in Christian thought in order to evade the problem. That's what I'm trying to accomplish in this paper. I hope that it will be useful to this symposium to the extent that those of you who are working with Mormon theology would get some ideas as to what directions thought would have to go. That's the point and purpose of my effort here. So, with those preliminaries, we start with finitist theology and the problem of evil. The problem of evil is to justify the ways of God to man. To show that faith in a good and benevolent deity is not utterly irrational in a world replete with grotesque injustices, pointless suffering, and tragic death. The kingdom of the Lord rules over all, we are told, and the divine sovereign is plenteous in mercy, his providence extending even to the least of his creatures. Yet a child is brutally decapitated in Florida, his head left lying in a ditch to be discovered by recreating fishermen. A young girl is raped in Nevada and abandoned with her arms chopped off by her assailant. An old woman in Belfast is broiled in gasoline, the unintended victim of a terrorist's bomb. And nearly half the people on Earth never see a full and satisfying meal, with tens of thousands dying each year of starvation and wasting diseases, and countless others suffering irreparable losses in those natural disasters ironically known as acts of God. Under these circumstances, if faith is not to be judged a naive and fatuous dream, some means must be found of reconciling the ubiquity and egregiousness of evil in the world with the compassion and justice religiously imputed to its divine governor. As Boethius asks, if there be a God, from whence proceed so many evils? Reflective Christians of the great Orthodox traditions have always found this question particularly troublesome, because their conception of God is one which makes him a party to every event in the universe, including all the evils which disfigure and destroy the lives of sentient beings. This is not because God is a perpetrator of evils, though he has been so regarded by some people, but rather because he knows of every evil occurrence, being omniscient, because he has the power to prevent or intercede in any evil sequence of events, being omnipotent, and because he bears unique responsibility for the overall structure and order of the universe, being its sole creator and unrivaled sovereign. And since the divine nature admits of no significant limitations on knowledge and power, considerations which tend to exculpate ordinary persons, such as pleas of ignorance, incompetence, or conflicting obligations, have no clear application. In every civilized system of morality and law, including those of Christian cultures, individuals who fail to render aid when they are able to do so are routinely regarded as accessories to the evils which they allow to occur. Thus, the divine character seems eminently impeachable under the under the commonplace principle that a moral agent is culpable in the occurrence of any evil of which he is aware, which he has the power to prevent or mitigate, and which he can prevent or mitigate without thereby precipitating a greater evil or seriously damaging his own legitimate interests. Christian apologists have, of course, responded to this situation with an impressive variety of arguments, some refusing to negotiate the issue on theological grounds, others attempting to show that God has morally sufficient reasons for allowing all the evil there is in the world to occur, and still others modifying traditional teachings concerning the divine nature in order to accommodate the obvious facts of the case. The first group develops a line of thought suggested in the book of Job to the effect that the ways of God are not the ways of men, that divine goodness is radically unlike human goodness, and for this reason, that the divine character can neither be comprehended nor evaluated by merely human minds. Just as the young child is unable to understand the motives of his parents, it is argued, human beings cannot comprehend the ways of a divine majesty which infinitely transcends their mortal capacities. And since we must accept as an article of faith that God is perfectly good, we may infer that he has praiseworthy reasons for what he does and permits, even though we cannot know what those reasons are. On the surface, this reasoning has a certain plausibility, since the concerns and responsibilities of Christianity's high God must far exceed those of any human agency, and since human reflection, and since honest reflection requires us to admit that our mortal wisdom is seriously limited at best. But this plausibility is available only at a price which the faithful cannot consistently pay, that of total agnosticism with regard to the values of their God. In other contexts, in prayer and preaching, for example, Christians espouse quite definite beliefs about the divine character, enthusiastically imputing justice, mercy, and benevolence to a God whom they regard as superlatively worthy of love. But if these practices are to make sense to them or anyone else, they must, as John Stuart Mill and others have shown, attribute to their deity exactly the same values that they accept themselves. For if the deity's goodness is radically different from human goodness, there is little reason for calling it goodness at all, and still less for praising and glorifying it, as faith is wont to do. The child who is totally ignorant of his parents' values has no reasons for admiring them, and still less for trying to emulate them. Thus the problem of evil cannot be evaded by pleas of ignorance concerning the content of God's goodness. A second and more promising approach is developed by a prestigious series of writers, beginning with St. Augustine, who confront the issue directly, admitting its enormous gravity, but arguing that God has morally sufficient reasons for creating a world susceptible to tragic evils and then allowing those evils to occur. Within this approach, the two most significant lines of thought are the free will defense and the eschatological theme, both of which are attempts to show that there are divine ends sufficiently valuable to justify the means necessary for their realization, including the construction of a world which is a veil of unrelieved tears for many of its inhabitants. The free will defense argues that it is a, or the, principal objective of the divine plan to develop a community of morally good persons who live in love and peace with one another and with God. But moral worth, it is argued, can only emerge from the refining fires of real temptation and genuinely free choice. This means that God must allow people to make effective decisions between good and evil, even though he knows that many of them will choose the latter with calamitous consequences. Innocence could be maintained without freedom, since a person who is unable to choose can do no wrong. But innocence is, it is claimed, is not valuable in the way that authentic goodness is. And if real moral worth is the goal, freedom and the risk of disaster are the logically inescapable price. For even omnipotence could not guarantee that freedom would always be used constructively without thereby destroying it. Thus, in order to develop the moral community which is his ultimate goal, God must allow human beings to decide freely despite the tragic consequences which eventuate from many of their choices. The free will defense is complemented by the eschatological theme, which seeks to account for the manifestly unjust distribution of trials and suffering in this world by invoking a doctrine of heavenly rewards and compensations. Here, the theologian acknowledges that ours is a world in which in which innocence suffers and viciousness prospers, and that the rain of accident, disease, and disaster falls indiscriminately upon the just as well as the unjust. But he argues that all will be put to rights in the divine kingdom beyond the grave. There the righteous will be rewarded for their virtue, the innocent compensated for their grief, and the celestial community will be forever free from misery, travail, and death. On this showing, life in the mortal sphere is a period of trial and testing, while life in the world to come sees the realization of justice, benevolence, and abundant compensation for undeserved suffering. And the goodness of God is putatively vindicated by the nobility of his purpose in the present world and the glory of its resolution in the next. Once again, these considerations have a certain plausibility, but as soon as we recall that God is believed to be the architect and originator of the entire arrangement, it is no longer evident that either line of argument supports the claim that he is just. The eschatological theme portrays him as consummately generous with those who have suffered through no fault of their own, but it offers no justification for their being victimized in the first place. Nor does it suggest what could count as fair and just compensation for the more hideous and grotesque evils of this life. It does predict that the lion will finally lie down with the lamb, but it gives no hint as to how the lamb could find justice in that arrangement. If God allowed the victims to suffer in the first place, the fact that he rewarded them later might show him to be generous or ultimately compassionate, but it would not show him to be just and good throughout. The free will defense portrays the Creator as engaging in a noble experiment, setting human beings free to determine their own moral decision, to determine their own moral destinies, and allowing them real opportunities for effective decision. But it does not show why it is necessary to allow free agents to commit horrendous crimes against their fellow humans, or to perpetuate gross injustices from generation to generation. Nor does it explain the obviously inequitable distribution of trials and temptations, which leave some lives in relative peace and prosperity, while others are permanently scarred and disfigured. Christians sometimes say that the Lord requires no one to carry a cross which is heavier than he or she can bear. But even if that were true, as it seems clearly not to be, it would not be evident from anything in the free will defense why some crosses must be so much more burdensome than others, or why some of the terrible crosses which are carried in this world must be borne at all. The ends of the divine experiment may thus be noble and elevating, but the means of their realization are in no sense just and good. In view of all these difficulties, it appears that no real alternative to modifying the traditional teachings about the divine nature, in order to accommodate the obvious facts of the case. If it is to be shown that God is just and good, it must be denied that he is responsible for the specific conditions in which we work out our moral destinies, and it must not be admitted that he is a morally involved parties to the evils endemic to human life. I will argue that theological finitism, the doctrine which substantially curtails orthodox claims concerning God's omnipotence, omniscience, and status as cosmic architect, can accomplish this objective, but only at the expense of denying, or as some say nowadays, demythologizing, much that is said in the Bible and elsewhere about the activities of God. Finitism can, I believe, maintain a religiously venerable conception of deity, holding God to be the ultimate locus and exemplar of love and creative advance. But it can do this only by abandoning the stories of mighty acts and interventions which form much of the central core of Orthodox tradition. First, it must be denied that God is solely or primarily responsible for the design and creation of the world, since that world is so patently unjust and unmerciful to many, if not most, of its inhabitants. There are independent reasons for rejecting the notion of a divine architect, as Hume and others have shown, but if the idea of a designer were insisted upon, it might be held that God is one of a cluster of coeval powers responsible for the organization of the universe under conditions which precluded any one of the powers from achieving dominance over the others. In this way, the desirable features of the structure could be attributed to the deity, while the rest were laid at the doors of forces he could not control. Or, more plausibly, finitism might see God simply as the eternal and primal source of spirituality, selfless love, and intelligent creativity. And it might maintain that there are signs of his influence throughout the universe, throughout the structure and history of the universe, wherever positive values prevail over the forces of darkness and destruction. And here, with the literal doctrine of creation being given up, the ancient idea of the Imago Dei might be reinterpreted to mean that humans reflect the divine nature to the extent that they are capable of exhibiting intelligence, creativity, and love. The second finitist move will be a drastic curtailment of the traditional claims made about divine power, not only denying the orthodox doctrine of omnipotence, but also insisting that God has none of the miraculous powers ordinarily attributed to him in the religious literature. For the problem of evil is utterly intractable with regard to any deity possessing such powers. There are simply too many avoidable and unrelieved agonies in our world to allow it as a serious possibility that a just and benevolent God has the ability to intervene, but refrains from doing so except on rare and unpredictable occasions. Accordingly, the finitist will argue that God has only those powers which are inherent in the perfect love and creative intelligence that are his essential characteristics. He will contend that the way of the divine is not that of forceful and dramatic moving and shaking, but rather of subtle attraction and gentle persuasion. And he will insist that there is more than a little biblical support for the belief that loving non-resistance to evil is ultimately the greatest power in the world. Finally, with respect to divine omnipotence, the finitist will see no need to deny that God knows all that can be known, but he is likely to insist that the range of possible knowledge is rather more restricted than orthodoxy admits. Thus, he will accept the idea that the divine intelligence is comprehensively aware of all that takes place in the world, but he will deny that God has infallible knowledge of every future occurrence, because that doctrine conflicts with the view that moral agents are free in their decisions. And he may well believe that God possesses a perfect understanding of the laws governing the behavior of everything which moves, changes, or acts. But he will reject the tendency to cast God in the role of a cosmic forecaster who could, and therefore should, warn potential victims of impending misfortunes. Whatever the content of the divine mind might be, and however that content might be assembled, its presence cannot be such as to admit direct access by human minds on pain of reintroducing the problem of evil. And it can't include full knowledge of the future on pain of denying freedom. But if these qualifications are allowed, there is no further reason for denying it the name of omniscience. These revisions, of course, would have a very drastic impact on familiar religious discourse. They would deny the traditional doctrine of creation in order to avoid the charge that God deliberately condemned half of humanity to misery as a means of teaching moral lessons to the other half. They would eliminate such stories as that of the conversion of Saul on the road to Damascus, because the power envisaged there breeds responsibility for such omissions as the failure to turn away the wrath of Adolf Hitler before the Holocaust. And they would reject the view of the divine mind, which sees it as a limitless repository of information to be dealt out at random intervals to a few individuals, since that idea of omniscience has no answer to the question why more than 24 boys and young men had to die before the Atlanta police were able to find their murderer. In short, they would sacrifice divine power in order to defend divine goodness, revering the ancient vision which saw God as love. I know of no theologians or philosophers who actually espouse the finitist doctrine I have proposed here. I have found suggestions of parts of it in the work of John Stuart Mill, E.S. Brightman, Paul Tillich, Charles Hartshorne, and Sterling McMurrin, and in an excellent paper on the problem of evil in Mormon theology, written as an undergraduate research project in my department by James R. Smith. The virtues I claim for it are just two: that it avoids the problem of evil, and that it is responsive to some of the sensibilities of religious tradition. If we conceive of God as that being which is uniquely worthy of worship, it might well be worth considering how loyal we should remain to the adoration of sheer power.
I'll begin, too, with a statement of what I intend here. I would like to keep the discussion initially at the level that Professor Appleby has suggested, namely talking about the finitistic position in regard to the problem of evil, raise a serious objection to the point of his paper, but I hope you'll be able to sense that fundamentally we're in agreement. It's just I hope that my remarks might cause us to broaden, if not deepen, our thoughts about this issue. And at the end of my paper, I want to take an option to just present some very tentative ideas about a Mormon response to the problem of evil. It's obvious that the phrase, the problem of evil, stands for at least two different problems, and that confusion results in determining the relative merits of any theodicy if this is not kept in mind. I concur with those who claim that there is something wrong with the way the problem of evil is traditionally stated. That is, that there are serious objections to any attempt to solve the problem by qualifying either or both of the central terms, God and evil. I will argue that the full force of the conflict, as well as an appreciation of what would count as a solution to the problem of evil, will come to light only when we begin to deal with it as a need to reconcile man, more so than God, with the phenomenon of evil. Viewed from one vantage point, the need to reconcile God and evil is what the problem of evil is all about. This is the thrust of Professor Appleby's paper. This is what is traditionally meant by the phrase. The standard Christian means of effecting this reconciliation is by interpreting evil either as an illusion or as negatively real, operating on the presumption that God is incompatible with evil taken as positively real. Dealing with the problem in these terms, it is clear that finitism is in opposition to Orthodox Christian thought over the meaning of evil, since, presumably, finitism requires that evil be understood as positively real, even with some instances of evil being taken as simply gratuitous. The conflict between this view of evil and the classical Christian view of evil is joined at this point, with the latter holding that all instances of evil can be justified and hence explained. The finitist would counter by arguing that while much that appears to be evil vanishes as knowledge and experience increase, and although often what is thought to be evil may prove eventually to be a positive good, still there are left those genuine evils, both moral and natural, which cannot be explained away, and whose genuineness means they must be real for God as well as for man. The question is, what could it possibly mean to say that some instances of evil cannot be explained away and seem to serve no purpose, the finitist view? Or, for that matter, what does it mean to say that all instances of evil are explainable, the classical theist position? M.B. Ahern, in his important study of the problem of evil, a book by that title, points out that consideration of these matters poses the following dilemma. Whatever evil actually occurs may be necessary for a greater good, but from our limited perspective, we cannot see all of the world's evils, all of the world's good, or all of the possible connections, if any, between the two. And thus it seems it is impossible to devise a theory to justify all evil. But this is not the threat to classical theism that some finitists might presume. To require of classical theists that they account for all instances of evil in order that their position be viable is mistaken. It is no criticism against classical theism that it cannot do what cannot be done. In other words, the logic of the situation requires that when finitists, such as the case here, argue that unless evil which is prima facie gratuitous can be shown to be necessary for good, this amounts to a sufficient reason for rejecting classical theism. When they make that claim, I take it, they're simply mistaken. This amounts to a reason for rejecting the classical view of God, because since it is not possible to show that all actual evil is justified, it may never be justified. But this does not amount to a sufficient reason against classical theism or for finite theism, because the nature of the problem makes it such that the logical impossibility of all evil being justified eventually cannot be done. To show this, we would need to establish a negative fact, namely that the good which could justify evil will never exist. And again, this cannot be done without exhaustive knowledge of the world's goods, of the world's good, which is not available to us. Hence, the force of the finitist argument against classical theism, and correspondingly in favor of finite theism in reference to the problem of evil, must be considerably weakened. But likewise, the classical theist must be willing to rest on a modified position. Because we cannot know all of the world's good or evil or the connections between the two, it follows it is impossible for the classical theist to show that all instances of evil are justified and hence explainable. Both the finite theists and the classical theists ought to agree that it cannot be shown whether or not actual evil is justified, and that the world's evil is not a decisive ground for rejecting the classical view of God, but neither is it a decisive ground for adopting finite theism. Ahern, whom I have already quoted, holds that if God is said to be limited in power, and if he neither created the world nor can prevent evil which occurs in it, those who hold this view, quote, avoid every problem of evil, but they face other problems, unquote. Such a being of limited power would, quote, not be the God of most believers. He would not be a fitting object of the kind of worship they give, which supposes that a greater being is inconceivable and that complete submission to God's will is justified since he cannot make mistakes. H.P. Owen, in his book The Concepts of Deity, comes virtually to the same conclusion. But it's J.N. Findlay, in his celebrated article, Can God's Existence Be Disproved?, who most pronouncedly challenges all those who profess belief in a finite God. He does this not so much in dealing with the problem of evil, but based on his understanding of the attitudes of religious worship. Findlay observes that attitudes presume certain characteristics in their objects, and that the presence or absence of these characteristics is a crucial determinant of the appropriateness of an attitude in a given case. Hence, reflection on the nature of religious attitudes leads, he says, irresistibly toward a view of God as that which is unsurpassable in every respect. Only a being which far exceeds human levels of power, wisdom, love, and other respected qualities could be an appropriate object of the deference, awe, and devotion involved in religion. But Findlay goes even further than this. It would be wholly anomalous to worship anything limited in any way, he says. This is because all limited superiorities are, quote, tainted with an obvious relativity and can be dwarfed in thought by still mightier superiorities. A worthy object of worship, quote, can never be a thing which merely happens to exist or one on which all other objects merely happen to depend, unquote. The only possible adequate object of worship, following this interpretation, quote, should have an unsurpassable supremacy along all avenues, it should tower infinitely over all other objects, unquote. This objection to finite theism does not hold. I agree with this point. Professor Appleby does too in the article that he wrote on religious attitudes in 1970 in the journal Religious Studies. I recommend it. I've tried to argue that. That was the subject of a paper that I delivered last year at the Sunstone Conference. This objection to finite theism does not hold. A finite or limited God, I think, can be shown to function as an acceptable object of religious worship. To understand God along finitistic lines might be said to be a drawback to a finitistic theodicy, but only as long as the worth of a position is judged along traditional lines, the way we normally talk about the problem of evil. And this is precisely my point. To view God as finite and to interpret evil as positively real results in our having to think of the problem of evil not so much as a need theoretically to reconcile God and evil, but as a need practically to meet evil head on and marshal ways to overcome it. And consequently, it seems the position must be judged not so much on whether a finite God best reconciles with evil, but on whether this view of God, along with other beliefs, best contributes to our being able to grapple with evil. William James, for one, comes to view the problem of evil in this light. He was convinced that the problems that evil present to us are not speculative, but practical. That the problem of evil is not finally about God, but about us and how we are to live in this world. The issue for James is not how to reconcile God and evil, but how we are to confront and fight against evil and opposition and overcome these things. Quote, not why evil should exist at all, but how can we lessen the actual amount of it is the sole question we need consider, unquote. James, in his writings, and particularly in the Varieties of Religious Experience, makes reference to a painting that hangs in the Louvre, painted by René, of St. Michael with his foot on Satan's neck. The richness of the painting, he observes, is in part largely due to the fiend's figure being there. And also, the richness of its allegorical meaning is having a devil in it. Quote, so long as we keep our foot upon his neck, unquote. For the religious person, James argues, from the real practical point of view, this is the way the fiend, the negative or tragic principle, evil in short, is experienced and ought to be dealt with. This, I take it, is what any finitistic theodicy, finitistic approach to the problem of evil reduces to. And thus, the next issue, which needs to be investigated in greater detail, is the extent to which this kind of theodicy enables us to confront and deal with evil. Finally, a brief observation about a Mormon approach to the problem of evil. I agree with Professor Appleby. Not only does there not exist a kind of definitive statement about the Mormon view of God, there certainly does not exist a definitive statement about the Mormon position on the problem of evil. When the problem is viewed along traditional lines, that is, as a need to reconcile God to evil, Mormonism would clearly appear to side with the finitists, given what has been taught about the nature of God in the tradition. The major question is whether or not finite theism is really the Mormon view of God. Certainly from the position of contemporary authoritative teachings on this topic, God for the Mormons is not finite or limited. I quote from an address by Elder McConkie, June the 1st, 1980, to Brigham Young University. Quote, there are those who say that God is progressing in knowledge and is learning new truths. This is false, utterly, totally, and completely. There is not one sliver of truth in it. It grows out of a wholly twisted and inaccurate view of the King Follett sermon and of what is meant by eternal progression. God progresses in the sense that his kingdoms increase and his dominions multiply, not in the sense that he learns new truths and discovers new laws. God is not a student. He has indeed graduated to that state of exaltation which consists of knowing all things and having all power. Why anyone should suppose, why anyone should suppose that an infinite and eternal being who has presided in our universe for almost 2,555,000 years, who made the sidereal heavens, whose creations are more numerous than the particles of the earth, who was aware of the fall of every sparrow, why anyone would suppose that such a being has more to learn and no new truths to discover in the laboratories of eternity is totally beyond comprehension. Will he one day learn something that will destroy the plan of salvation and turn man and the universe into uncreated nothingness? The saving truth, as revealed to and taught by the prophet Joseph Smith, and I find this key in this address, the language that he explicitly uses, the saving truth as revealed and taught by the prophet Joseph Smith is that God is omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. He knows all things, has all power, is everywhere present by the power of his Spirit. And unless we know and believe this doctrine, we cannot gain faith unto life and salvation. There are writers in the church who argue that such absolutistic talk about God can be reconciled to older pronouncements about God that suggest that he is limited or finite. Jean England, a professor at BYU, for instance, suggests a reconciliation by urging us to contemplate, quote, two spheres of existence expressed by, quote, two modes of discourse. Yet this approach, it seems to me, in no way solves the metaphysical problems inherent in teaching that God can be at once finite or limited and infinite and absolute. But the more serious challenge to the suggestion that the Mormons view God as limited or finite rests with, it seems to me, the evidence that the vast majority of members of the church, especially in the last few decades, simply do not view God this way. For them, I would contend, God is unqualifiedly supreme, absolute in every respect. Hence, if one deals with the problem of evil as a problem about God, I think a strong case can be made for the observation that Mormons, if what they say about God is taken at face value, confront all of the same kinds of dilemmas about God and the reality of evil as do all other classical Christians, the very points enumerated in Professor Appleby's paper. But, as I suggest, the problem of evil can also be viewed as a problem not so much about God, but about ourselves, and about how we are to deal with the opposition and evil in our lives. From this perspective, the nature of the problem changes markedly. And here I would suggest that a Mormon solution, in quotes, to the problem of evil has considerable merit. The tradition's unqualified affirmation of the goodness of the individual and its acknowledgement of the efficacy and worth of human effort cast in an eternal perspective, combined with the view of divine goodness symbolized in Christ as the Redeemer, provide not only a rationalization but more importantly a spiritual motivation for encountering suffering and evil and striving to overcome these things. And what is more, to view evil as genuinely real, as the Mormons do, and as that which in some instances cannot be explained away, and to be reminded, as Sterling McMurrin says, that the Mormon tradition teaches us that, quote, the vocation of man is found in the primary experience of moral struggle, unquote, is to inculcate in us a sense of the mystery of evil and of our inability ever fully to comprehend it or even finally the ways of God, all of which can contribute to a more profound appreciation on our part of what needs of the need we have to continually struggle to find meaning in life and to appreciate the role in life of faith in God. Yet even here, while the Mormon position is distinctive, it is not unique. In fact, I think it finds its place in a great and long-established tradition, namely in the biblical approach to the problem of evil. I'd like to conclude by retelling a story that is told by the contemporary Jewish writer Elie Wiesel of an experience that he witnessed as a young boy in Auschwitz during the war. Wiesel tells of how in his camp, in the barrack that he was in, some of the wise Jewish men assembled themselves together. These were learned men who before the war had positions of authority and stature in the community. All of them knew the Talmud by heart. They assembled themselves in a very serious atmosphere and proposed the need to putting God on trial. Carefully, the arguments in favor of God in light of what was happening were presented. The arguments against God were presented. The entire thing took place in a very serious, dramatic, and solemn atmosphere. The men knew that what they said was being heard, what they were doing was being taken account of. After 2 days, they parted, went their separate ways, only to assemble again and to come to the verdict. The head of the tribunal polled his colleagues, stood before them, and spoke solemnly the verdict: guilty. And then he said, "Now we must return to prayer." It's that kind of view that I think is, in fact, potentially inherent in the Mormon view and in other views about the problem of evil, if seen in this different light.
Perhaps I'll just very briefly respond to a couple of comments here. I think that Professor Bradford is correct in discerning a radical difference in perspective on just what the problem is here. I confess that I'm a little surprised about his account of contemporary Mormon doctrine, but I can't comment on that since I really am not a scholar in these matters, moving in the direction of the absolutistic conception. But on the problem, as I stated it and as he responded to it, I think it can be conceded that if we were to undertake an inventory of the world's specific evils, that is, make a list, start out with that child decapitated in Florida, move on to the rape victim with her arms chopped off in Nevada, it would be unfair and inappropriate to demand of the theist that he or she account for each of those evils serially. I think the point of the question that I raised, however, is a little bit different, and that is that it's hard to imagine what could count as justification for the occurrence of that sort of thing. Not to say, why did this happen to this girl or that boy, but what could count as justification for the occurrence of this kind of thing in a universe where there was a power which could, if he chose, stop it or prevent it. Now, two comments perhaps will illuminate that remark. You may recall that in the Brothers Karamazov
Ivan Karamazov has a debate with his religious brother Alyosha, in which he asks Alyosha whether Alyosha would consent to an arrangement where the most glorious imaginable kingdom of heaven that he could think of, whether he would be willing to participate in the establishment of that kingdom of heaven if the cornerstone of the kingdom had to be laid on the dead body of an executed child. And Alyosha said no. And I believe that Alyosha was right, that kind of arrangement is so manifestly unjust that it's not a matter of picking particular cases and saying, why did this happen, but of why could such things happen at all? And the sense of justification is lost there. One other example. This morning, in a very interesting discussion of the theology which comes out of 19th century Mormon funeral sermons, Dr. Robert Fowles talked about a tendency in some sermon, in some funeral sermon, some funeral preaching, to trivialize death. Now, there are strong otherworldly tendencies in much of traditional Christian thought. And one might say, at least from one's own point of view, passing beyond the veil and so on, this doesn't matter. Right? Death, where is thy sting? But if we take seriously the kind of biblical injunctions as to moral concerns that, in fact, Professor Bradford was talking about the end of his talk, about reducing evil, about loving our brother, about eliminating injustice, then it's very difficult for me to understand, unless we simply trivialize the whole set of values to which Christians are enjoined to subscribe, how we can end up saying, well, it all works out in the long run, somehow or another these things are justified, I don't know how, but God is absolutely in control. That seems to me to be the problem, and I have suggested a radical finitism as a way of avoiding it. I can't see how it is otherwise avoidable.